evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Trevor Morrison. Morrison is a graduate of Columbia Law School. He clerked for Judge Betty Fletcher of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit in New York and for Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg of the Supreme Court of the United States. His scholarship has appeared in many law journals, including the Yale Law Journal and the Cornell Law Review. He's currently an associate professor at the Cornell University Law School. Welcome to the show, Trevor.
Thanks for having me.
Now, I wanted to talk to you about some of the legal and political issues of the day, some of the things that we've been hearing about in the news.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to start with the Supreme Court and its, you know, its evolution. So, now, my understanding is that Article 3 of the Constitution set up a Supreme Court but didn't advise on the specific direction that it was supposed to go.
Absolutely.
So let's talk about that.
Okay. Yeah, Article 3 of the Constitution, you're right, is the article that addresses the judicial branch generally, and it requires that there be a Supreme Court. One thing that it doesn't require is that there be any lower federal courts. So the existence of the federal judiciary other than the Supreme Court is a matter of congressional choice, not constitutional command.
Wow.
Ever since the Judiciary Act of 1789, there have been lower federal courts, and their jurisdiction has expanded and contracted some over time. And then the job of the Supreme Court is spelled out to some degree within Article 3, but there are a lot of things about the way the court does its business today that's not a matter of constitutional command. For example, the Constitution doesn't specify how many people have to be on the court, so that's...
And I understand it started out with just a justice and five members. Is that correct?
That's right. There were six members.
Six members.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Each justice is normally... We speak of the Chief Justice and then Associate Justices.
Mm-hmm.
So that was specified, again, in the Judiciary Act of 1789. And the total size of the court fluctuated quite a bit through the late 18th and 19th centuries. At its peak, there were 10 members on the court during President Lincoln's administration. And it settled at 9 in the late 19th century. The most recent sort of episode where there was a threat to increase the number of members of the court is the famous court packing episode from FDR's administration, when the court was then striking down a lot of federal legislation that was being passed as part of the New Deal. FDR's frustration with that led him basically to threaten to increase the number of people on the court and then to fill those new vacancies with people he knew would be sympathetic to his legal program. And that was regarded by many at the time, and I think many of us today, as nearly a constitutional crisis.
I'll
that
bet.
Kind of sort of politically motivated meddling with the court could be really troublesome. Some of the changes in size in the court in the 19th century could be described that way, in fact. But
well, yeah, I want to talk a little bit about that.
Mm-hmm.
When did they actually decide that they had the power to consider the constitutionality of laws?
Right.
I mean, that didn't happen till later. My understanding, it was, you know, 1801 or something like that.
Well, the case that we always cite, the case that American law students in constitutional law courses are often taught as the very first case, is Marbury versus Madison, decided by the court in 1803. Not the first case decided by the Supreme Court, but in many ways the first big case decided by the Supreme Court. And the most famous line in that case is that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judicial department to say what the law is. And that's, you know, just to say it isn't necessarily to say what it means. But what the court was doing there through one of its greatest members, Chief Justice John Marshall,
I was just going to bring that up, yeah,
was staking out the power to inspect laws passed by Congress for whether they are consistent with the Constitution's prohibitions and requirements, and to the extent that the court thinks that a law is not consistent with the Constitution, to strike it down. And that's actually a number of steps sort of packed into one. There's the assertion of the court's own power to review statutes for their constitutionality, or for that matter, just actions by the government for their constitutionality. And there's a further assertion, which is more implicit than explicit in what Marshall said, that the court's judgment would be final. That is, that it wouldn't be open for Congress or the president to say, well, we simply disagree. We think, in fact, this is constitutional. The power of judicial review, as it's called, that's the term that we use for the exercise of this power, really, I think, entails both. But it's the second part where the greatest controversy lies, and it's really an ongoing debate even today about the extent to which the Supreme Court really is final. I think it's generally accepted that its word on constitutional meaning is final. But there's a lot to think about around the edges of
that. Yeah, I'm going to ask you some specific questions about that. But I know the Supreme Court's the last resort for people who feel like they weren't treated fairly by the lower courts or that they failed them somehow. Now, because this is the case, why is the Supreme Court seemingly so secretive?
Well, that's a good question. I guess there are a lot of things going on there. One point that's often made, in fact, the year I was clerking at the court, Chief Justice Rehnquist used to take the clerks from each of the other chambers out to lunch at some point in the year, and he told us, Ginsburg clerks, just as he told the others, one of his favorite lines is from an earlier member of the court who said, two courts is enough for justice. And what he meant by that is you don't get an appeal to the Supreme Court as a matter of right just because there's been some injustice, you think, in your case. In fact, the Supreme Court, at least today, it's the nature of its jurisdiction has changed over time, but the vast majority of the cases the court hears in its own discretion. There isn't an appeal as of right for the losing party below. So the thought is entailed in two courts is enough for justice is that, you get a trial court, and if it's in the federal court system, then you can appeal as a matter of right, usually if you lose to a federal circuit court, which is the intermediate level within the federal judiciary. But to go to the Supreme Court, there has to be something more in the case than simply the losing party being convinced that some grave injustice has been done. There has to be a legal question that really goes beyond the importance of that particular case.
It would have to entail affecting the country and the Constitution as a whole.
So there are certain kinds of cases like that. When a lower court exercises the power of judicial review and strikes down an act of Congress as unconstitutional, that's something that the Supreme Court may well have to look at because that's a big deal for the courts to set aside the work product of the democratically elected branches. Also, if there's disagreement between different lower courts, so if the Ninth Circuit out in California and the Second Circuit in New York disagree over the meaning of a particular statute, that's a good candidate for the Supreme Court's review because it's thought to be intolerable for one statute to mean different things in different parts of the country. Now, none of that really answers secrecy, but I wanted to bring it up just because I think people often think of the court as this sort of last place of redress when an injustice has been done. And I'm not sure that members of the court think of their job as principally in those terms. I think they think of it as having more to do with addressing legal issues whose importance goes beyond the individual case. There are exceptions, of course. There can be sort of cases whose own facts make them so important that the court takes them, even though it may not raise some issue of larger importance. Now, as to secrecy, you're right. There are a lot of things about the way the court carries out its business that that mark it as far more secret than other branches of our government. Oral argument is open to the public, though it's not televised, and there's ongoing controversy about that.
Constant struggle about that, yeah.
Justice Souter is known to have said that TV cameras will enter the Supreme Court's main chamber over his dead body. And Justice Souter is pretty healthy, so I don't think... And that, I think over the last decade, there's been a move towards some greater sort of openness there. The court in really big cases will make available the recorded audio transcript of arguments pretty much immediately, and C-SPAN and other outlets will broadcast them. But, even if that became completely open, the real action, of course, is what are the justices doing when they're talking to one another and deciding what to do in a case? Not only is that closed to the public, but it's closed to everybody else in the building, too. No law clerk can be in that room when the justices are casting their votes in cases.
That's a really interesting aspect of the final word in a democracy.
Right.
Now I also want to know about the fact that, the Supreme Court is in the business of interpreting the Constitution. So when did it become this big ideological tug-of-war about who's the president, who's going to pick the next justice? Why is it a big right-wing, left-wing, Democrat-Republican tug-of-war if they're really supposed to be interpreting and not bringing in ideology? I mean, in a perfect world, obviously.
Well, yeah, there's a lot in that question that you've raised. part of it is just a historical question. When did it start becoming as contentious as it is? I think my understanding of the history is there have really been sort of episodes in that, and we're in a historical moment that can be traced back at least to the failed nomination of Robert Bork during the Reagan administration, and arguably earlier as a period. Some might say that the court's decision in Roe versus Wade, at least for certain parts of the political spectrum, really sort of raised the political stakes in all succeeding nominations to the court. But there were earlier historical moments too, when Brandeis, which is one of the great justices on the court, when he was nominated, there was quite a bit of media and other coverage, and it was thought to be controversial for many because he was known to be a proponent of social welfare legislation and a foe of large corporate interests, and so there was a considerable controversy then. One big difference, though, is with the sort of 24-hour news cycle, et cetera, is that the level of scrutiny that's brought to bear is much greater, I would say, in the last 20 years. Now, why should there – the other part of your question is why should there be all of this scrutiny and controversy if what we think a judge is supposed to do is simply say what the law means, say what the law is? Well, you know, that's fine in theory, but the Constitution in particular – of course, the Supreme Court and other federal courts do a lot more than just interpret the Constitution. But if we think about constitutional cases, which is where most of the biggest controversies lie, the Supreme Court is called upon to interpret a document that's over 200 years old and that in many of its most important passages is really quite textually spare. So there's the Due Process Clause, right, which says that no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. That's not a clause that defines itself. So to figure out whether that clause has been complied with or violated in any particular case requires more than simply reading those words on the page. And at that point, it may be inevitable. Some think it's inevitable that ideological priors become involved in the work of judging. Now, we teach our law students that there's ways to be rigorous about the law and not simply to reduce it to politics. And I certainly think that's true. But that doesn't mean that there's that law is somehow free of battles over over values, over ideology. Really, I think you could argue that if that were not the case, then the law might be rather pointless.
Well, it does make a lot of members of the public cynical about this court because, you know, obviously ideology does seem to come in rather than even judicial prowess. You know, I mean, a lot of people have been appointed to the Supreme Court who don't seem to be very storied.
I think that's fair. It's maybe... you know, those of us who spend our careers sort of teaching the law might like to think that the very ablest and brightest people would get lower court judges or professors would get appointed to the court. And I think there have been a great many extremely able members of the court over time. But that's obviously not the only thing that a president is thinking about, nor should it necessarily be. I think wisdom and, say, pure intellectual horsepower are not necessarily the same thing. You know, and I guess the other thing I'd want to say about sort of the public cynicism about the court is that a lot of it is understandable, of course, and it's shared by those of us who, you know, watch what the court does closely. At least it's sometimes shared by us. But one important thing about the way the court operates that makes it different from, say, the way a member of Congress operates in just deciding how to vote on a bill that comes before the House or Senate, is the court is required to issue opinions, or at least by convention it issues opinions, justifying the results it reaches. And even if you think that all or most members of the court are just motivated by politics in the way they resolve cases, they are still constrained, I think, by whether a particular outcome can be supported with reason. And I often make the point to my students that there are many areas of the law where there's no obviously right answer, but there are lots of wrong answers, outcomes you just can't write yourself to. And I think that may be one important way in which the court is different from other institutions of government.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Trevor Morrison. He's an associate professor at Cornell University's Law School. Now, I want to talk about the fact that if judicial decisions that are coming out of the Supreme Court are totally out of step with what the majority thought is in a democracy, is there any redress for people to change any of these decisions?
Sure. There's in theory, there are ample opportunities. In practice, they may be somewhat fewer. You know, the first thing is it depends what kind of case we're talking about. So if what the Supreme Court has done is interpret a statute, right, in a way that people think is just sort of ridiculously out of step with, say, what Congress wanted when it passed that statute, well, Congress is entirely free to effectively correct the Supreme Court's misunderstanding by amending its statute and to say, you know, the Supreme Court read the statute to mean X, but we meant Y, and now we're being clear. That's not thought to be a threat to the Supreme Court's ultimate power at all, because Congress is simply changing what the law is, right? The court was interpreting the statute passed in time one, and Congress has responded by passing a new statute. Now, in theory, that's all well and good. Of course, political scientists who study the legislative process and who know how difficult it can often be to get any kind of statute through the many sort of veto gates that are set up in the legislative process will say, you know, that's much easier in theory than in fact. For other cases raising constitutional questions, there are options that are, again, easier to articulate in theory than to achieve in practice. But the main one would be constitutional amendment, right, to respond to what the court has said about the meaning of a particular constitutional provision by amending the Constitution. And of course, we have a great many amendments, but the amendment process is not an easy gauntlet to run. It's designed to be very difficult to amend the United States Constitution, and indeed it is.
Oh, absolutely. And then think about the amendment, how long it took for the women to get the right to vote.
Right.
That amendment that happened, was it 1920?
19 or 20, yeah.
Yeah. It took a long time.
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah. And, you know, I think it's really a very complicated process, too. More recently, one thinks of the Equal Rights Amendment proposed in the 1970s, which ultimately failed. You know, one reason why, arguably why it didn't succeed, was that at the same time there was agitation for that amendment to be passed, the court began changing the way it read the Constitution we already have and began to be more suspicious under the Equal Protection Clause, which is part of the 14th Amendment, began to be more suspicious of laws that differentiated on the basis of sex or gender. Mm. My former boss, Justice Ginsburg, before she became a justice, was one of the people leading that litigation effort and, in fact, argued pretty much all of the most important cases before the court in the 1970s, argued those cases all under the Equal Protection Clause. Now, of course, the more litigation becomes successful in advancing gender equality under that clause, the more the momentum for something like the Equal Rights Amendment might be dissipated by that. So I think there's a very complicated relationship between ongoing litigation efforts under the Constitution we have and any attempt to amend. And then, of course, even if a majority of the states and a majority of people across the country desire a particular amendment, the Constitution requires supermajorities and makes it, you know, just simply very difficult to change the Constitution we have.
Before we run out of time, I also want to talk about an issue that's been on the national plate for quite some time, and that is this so-called war on terror.
Right.
How can a war that really is sort of an ideological war help a president change so many laws, which is what seems to have been happened in the Bush administration?
Well, that's a hard question. Many have remarked that this term, the war on terror, is an unfortunate term. Unfortunate, I think, for, among others, the president himself, right? I would not want to be a president responsible for fighting a war against something as abstract as terror, because I don't know how I could ever credibly declare victory.
Absolutely.
And, you know, conceptually, even beyond that, I think it's just it's hard to know what the boundaries of such a war would be. And I think that's where your question comes from. Is something as open-ended as that, does it entail a sort of blank check for assertions of presidential power?
Well, that seems to be what's happening.
Well, maybe. Sometimes I think that's right. But the more technically accurate way that the court sort of engages with these questions is to examine not broad assertions of a war on terror, but particular legal instruments. And so in this respect, arguably the most important or one of the most important instruments of law since 9/11 was passed in the immediate aftermath of those attacks. And that's what's called the AUMF for short, or the Authorization for Use of Military Force. And this is a law passed by Congress, I think, on September 18th, 2001, but in any event, not long after the attacks, that granted very broad authority to the president to use force against those people and organizations he deemed to be responsible for the attacks or affiliated with those people who were responsible for the attacks. And so when the Supreme Court gets cases involving, say, the detention of alleged enemy combatants and trying to figure out the scope of the president's authority to detain people without trial in that circumstance, well, the authority question, that is, does the president have this power, the court has answered first with reference to the authority that Congress gave him when it passed the authorization for use of military force. And that statute is narrower than the war on terror, right? The president at least has to make some kind of showing that he's credibly found the people against whom he's acting to have been either responsible for the attacks or affiliated with, so members of Al-Qaeda or something. And that's it's still very open-ended, and there are many assertions of authority that are that continue to be examined in the courts, not just the Supreme Court, but the lower courts too, with respect to the detention of alleged enemy combatants who were picked up, you know, nowhere near Afghanistan, nowhere near Iraq. They were picked up in Bosnia, you know, and they have no connection to 9/11 at all, at least as far as anyone can see. But if one focuses on these, you know, more specific legal enactments, there's a way to sort of get some traction on this. You know, there are other statutes, though, like the Patriot Act, of course, which is in many ways a kind of grab bag of changes to the law, some of which don't have very much to do particularly with the war on terror at all, but they're sort of parts of, a cynic would say they're just parts of a prosecutor's wish list of things that they, or the intelligence community's wish list of things they wanted to have changed in the law anyway, like the hard wall between information gathered for criminal investigation purposes and for intelligence gathering purposes, a wall that had been part of our law, our statutory law for some time and policy, but that the Patriot Act changes in some ways, or the option of using different kinds of warrants, so-called sneak and peek warrants and other things. These are issues that had been debated within the law enforcement community for some time, and the Patriot Act sort of identifies 9/11 as a justification for making these moves.
Are people still trying to dissemble what exactly is in the Patriot Act? It seems like it passed so quickly, and it doesn't seem like anybody could have possibly known all the details of what they were getting us into.
Well, it's you know, the lawmaking process in Congress is often sort of like the sausage making process. You don't you don't want to see it up close, and so you know, the statute's got a lot of different provisions addressing a number of different issues, and one could ask, I suppose, how many members of Congress were intimately familiar with all the provisions of the Act.
Well, one of the provisions that really disturbs so many people is this domestic spying.
Well, I think you're referring to the NSA warrantless wiretapping thing.
That's right.
Which actually can't claim very much authority from the Patriot Act itself. The authority that the president has claimed for that comes from a combination of the AUMF, that other statute I mentioned, and an assertion of his own inherent authority under the Constitution. And you're right. I think that's been a deeply controversial issue. And so far, the courts have had very little to say about that.
That's another disturbance to many of us.
You know, one of the big problems that the courts face, that maybe that a democracy faces when we're dealing with exercises of extraordinary power in times of war or at least heightened national security risk, is that the ability of the other branches to check the branch that is exercising power depends on those branches knowing what's going on, right? So that information becomes sort of the key to the apparatus working. And one of the reasons for concern with the NSA, the warrantless wiretapping program, is that very few members of Congress were apprised of the existence of this program from its inception. And among those who were told anything about it, they were forbidden from consulting with their own legal advisors as to whether it was consistent with the laws they had passed, including a very important statute passed in the late 70s, the FISA statute, which is Congress's regulation of the use of this kind of intelligence gathering.
That they need to get a warrant.
And there's a special court.
Within, 72 hours or something?
Right. There's a special court, the FISA court, that Congress, through the statute, had set up. So it had provided for a way to engage in this kind of of intelligence gathering, but it required basically that the executive branch not be going it entirely alone. Now, whether the president's program here violated that statute or not depends on a pretty close inspection of just what's going on and the nature of the authority he's claiming under the
Constitution. Is he claiming this under the authority of being commander-in-chief?
That's part of it. There are basically two arguments that's being run there, and they're the same kind of arguments you see in almost every other issue, sort of post 9/11 executive power issue. One of the arguments is the constitutional argument that the Article II provision making him commander-in-chief of the military also gives him a sort of broad power inherently to engage in such action as he deems necessary to protect national security. There are other parts of Article II of the Constitution, which is the article addressing the president that he refers to as well, the so-called Take Care Clause. But the other argument that's made is a statutory argument that Congress, when it passed this AUMF, sort of gave the president, President Bush in press conferences has sometimes referred to that statute as just saying, Congress told me you've got what power you need, very open-ended reading, to do what you think you need to do to protect us. And, you know, I read the statute a little more narrowly than that, but it means that examining the assertion of authority, whether it's in the NSA context or any other, is both a constitutional question and a statutory question. And the problem, again, is that until recently, almost no one even knew of the existence of this program. And that's going to be very hard then for anyone to try and get a case before a court to examine it. And very recently, the Sixth Circuit just threw out a case that was trying to challenge this surveillance program because the parties, it said, had no standing. And so far, the courts have declined to involve themselves in reviewing this program.
We only have about a minute left. Do you think post 9/11 is going to bring on all kinds of new legal cases and precedents in our judicial systems?
Well, it already has, I think. I think of the enemy combatant detention cases that have already been up there, the Hamdi case, the Hamdan case, and this next term, one of the most important cases before the court next term is in the same area. So I don't think we know how the story is going to end, but this is a new important moment, I think, for the Constitution and the court.
Thank you so much for being with us, Trevor.
Thank you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are supported in part by Finger Lakes Arts Grants and Services. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.